ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः श्रृणुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तु नूभिः यशेम देवहितं यतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So we're on chapter 2, verse 9. There's a logic running through this chapter, and it's basically this. This waking state that we experience through our sense organs, this waking state is unreal, like the dream. It's mithya, vaitatyam. Mithya means it has no independent reality of its own. It depends totally for its being on something else, kind of like the snake depends on the rope. An imagined snake depends totally on the rope for its being. That's mithya. So, what Gaudapada, who is the author of the Karika, that is doing an analysis, a logical analysis of what is taught in the Mandukya Upanishad, is using this chapter, it's called the Vaitatya Prakarana, to establish the mithyatva of this entire creation. Of everything that exists that we experience within time and space, actually, with everything that we experience within duality. That's what's happening here. And so he's used a series of logics up to this point to establish this. And the basic premise or the basic syllogism that has to be proven, right? He just tells the syllogism, he tells what, he makes the statement, and then he has to go and establish. Because when he makes the statement, then you'll all go until it's understood. You go, well, how could that be so? So the statement is that this waking state that we experience is unreal just like the dream. It's mithya. It's a dependent reality. It has no being of its own, just like the dream. Why? Drishyatvat. Because it is seen. It is experienced. And that's it. So now he's going through so many different arguments to unfold the truth of this, that this waking state is as mithya, as apparent, as the dream state, and then you have to give a hetu for it, because it is perceived, because it is seen, because it's experienced by our sense organs. That's enough to reduce it to this mithyatva. And they've given some other arguments along the way, one very important argument, that goes along with drishyatvat. Drishyatvat means that which is perceived, that which is experienced, is this adyantau, because adyanta, everything that is experienced has a beginning, means it comes into being and it goes out of being. Anything in the creation is subject to time, it comes into being and it goes out of being. This is true in the dream state, it's also true in the waking state. It's also true in the dream state, everything is perceived. In the waking state, everything is perceived. Okay, subject-object relationship there. In the dream state and in the waking state, everything that is experienced comes into being and goes out of being. This is also a very important logic that he spent some time developing, and it'll be going all the way through with us also. Why that logic is important for grasping really the mithyatva. Mithyatva means that dependent nature, that lack of having any intrinsic being, where the intrinsic being that this creation enjoys actually depends upon something else for that. Like the two examples, we have clay pot and rope snake. These come in every class, clay pot and rope snake. Pot and the clay pot. Pot is useful, but it has no being of its own apart from the clay. What's so beautiful to understand about this relationship, and we'll see with the rope snake also, is that the pot is the clay, but the clay is free of the pot. That's the satya-mitya relationship. Satya means that which is actually there. Mitya is that which depends on what is actually there for its reality. So if I were to remove the clay out of the pot, there would be no pot, right? But I could squash the pot, and nothing happens to the clay. It's just the pot form is gone. If I took the pot and went like this, I can make it into a nice plate. I can then make it into a tumbler. I can do many, many things. The names and forms themselves come into being and go out of being. They themselves have no independence apart from the clay, but the clay is totally independent of the form. It survives the coming into being and going out of being of the form, but the form doesn't survive. If that form comes into being, it wasn't there before, it goes out of being, and now it's gone. If I change a cup into a plate, the cup is no more. You see what I mean? So this relationship, the whole Vedanta, the Advaita, non-duality, requires the understanding of this relationship. Because without understanding it, this relationship, how could we say that this whole creation that we experience is non-dual? The Upanishads, the Advaita Vedanta, Advaita means one without a second, that the reality of your being, of who you actually are, is one without a second. One without a second means that this simple presence that we were recognizing and just allowing to be myself in the meditation, right? Or we just allow the thoughts, as you notice, they come and go, the perceptions, sensory perceptions are coming and going, your imaginations, emotions, tensions and relaxation, all of these things are coming and going in your own simple presence. All of the experiences that you have in this waking state, all coming and going, right? Coming into being, going out of being. But what is it coming into being and going out of being is the being in which they're coming into and going out of. And that being is not an object to look at, you know. If it were an object to look at, then it would also be coming into being and going out of being because it would be bound by time. But that being which everything enjoys is the very, what we call adhishtana, the very substratum of all of these experiences that come and go, is, in the final analysis, me. I can't be one who's coming and going, because if the experience is gone and I'm still here, you know, I can't be that experience. I can't be an experience that leaves and I'm still here. And so this, what we call viveka, this discrimination has to be done, and has to be done very, very thoroughly. So what Gaudapada is doing, who is the author, this Gaudapada is actually the guru of Shankara's guru, right? And Shankaracharya is the main commentator in all of the Upanishads, who has them all in writing. And so here now, the whole Mandukya Upanishad is looking at the relationship of the simplicity of your being, this presence, to the wide birth of experiences that you have that we can categorize as the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. So in the waking state, all kinds of things happen. In the dream state, all kinds of things happen. In the deep sleep state, we're just at total rest. There's no experience of duality at that time. There's just what we say, a big, I don't know, you wake up when your mind's awake, and you can talk about the deep sleep state. There's no commentary going on at that time. But when the mind comes back into a waking state, into a manifest state, it will tell you all about that dream state. I don't know anything at that time. It's so restful. I slept so well. It was wonderful. I have all really nice things. When you get a deep sleep, everybody loves that. You know. So we can You can discuss it, but when the mind goes into that unmanifest condition, there's really no discussion taking place. So the Mandukya Upanishad really is talking about these three experiences that take care of all the levels of our experience. It takes care of the 24-hour day. And based upon those three experiences, it's looking at the reality, really, of all three of them. Using these three states of experience, it's looking at the reality of all three of them. See? So it's gone through a number of logics around that, but there's one thing to understand that makes this very important, why he's concentrating so much here on the dream. He's saying this waking state that we're experiencing is vaitatya, is mitya. Dependent reality has no being of its own, just like the dream. Why can he say that? Just like the dream. Because everybody looks at the dream as an imaginal state. You know, something that came out of your mind. It's your projection. You don't take the dream to be real. You take the that you say there's a reality that I had the dream experience. But you do see that the dream is something that comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. That's mitya. It's like if I ask you to have an imagination, like I use the meadow example. Imagine a beautiful meadow, the beautiful trees and the sun, a few wispy clouds and a nice breeze going through, and you and your friends are walking through the meadow. You can have a very complex, beautiful meadow imagination. That meadow comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. Right? So we say you are the adhishtana, or you are the truth, the being, the conscious being, actually the very knownness, which the whole meadow enjoys. So you would say this meadow imagination, or any imagination, or any thought for that matter, depends upon me, comes from me, sustained by me, goes, resolves into me. I remain, and the thought goes. I remain, the imagination goes. I remain, the dream goes. This dream is so valuable when we're trying to analyze the reality of who I actually am. There's a very important logic involved in all of this analysis called anvaya vyatireka. Knowledge, this little piece of logic goes like this. And we use this for analyzing or differentiating myself from all of my experiences, but particularly now differentiating my being from the waking, dream, and deep sleep state. And it goes like this. This is the logic. When this is, that is. So now if I say this first part, when this thing is, that is. Okay. Now I can think, okay, if this is, that is, maybe these two are correlated. Maybe they have a relationship. Maybe they're dependent upon one another, because when this thing is, that is. Okay. So now I would have to say also, and that's the anvaya, right? When this thing is there, this is there. This is there, this is there. That's the positive correlation. But and if the negative correlation is always there, where you also there, where you would say, and when this is not there, this is not there. When this is there, this is there. When this is not there, this is not there. Then I said, okay, these two have a real relationship because they depend upon each other, right? For their being. One is not doesn't exist independently of the other. But what if the positive correlation is there, the negative correlation is there. So we say, okay, there's a relationship here of dependency. So now what if you say like this, though? When this thing is, that is. Okay. When this thing is not, that still is. What does that mean? It means there can be some positive correlation. When this is here, that is there. But there's no identity, because when this thing goes, that is still here. You see what I mean? So there's no real relationship. So this little piece of logic is a huge clue. It's a it's a tool for your being able to figure out who you really are. Because in your experience, you're faced with this all the time. When this thought is here, I am here. When this thought is gone, I'm still here. If that's true, which I think that we know if you've done any kind of Vipassana or meditation or just watch the thoughts in your mind, the thought rises, this thought comes, it's replaced by this thought, 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 chain thinking. And if you just kind of sit and be kind of present to that situation, what you notice is that actually these thoughts are passing through. But I'm not passing through. I'm the one who is present to this chain of thoughts. And well, I can notice, I can do a discrimination of viveka, where I can actually notice the ongoing presence. In Sanskrit it's called that anuvritti, that ongoing presence of my being as all of these thoughts pass through. Similarly, that ongoing presence of my being in terms of the slower flow of emotional states. You know, I am sad, and then that sadness dissipates. Oh, I'm not sad. Then that can even become a shanti, or oh, I feel so peaceful. The slower rhythm of emotional states rising and setting in my own presence. So we can notice, we start noticing, we start performing this type of a viveka, this type of a discrimination where I notice that, ah, I was present to, instead of I am sad, what I start to notice is actually I am present to the sadness. I am present to the agitation. I am present to the shanti, to the joy, to the happiness. My being is stable. There's a stable presence that is there in all of these states of experience. And so I start recognizing this logic. When the thought is, I am. When the thought is gone, I still am. When the emotion is, I am. When the emotion is gone, I still am. And so then I start to notice that actually I am my very simple presence, this conscious being that I am. It's not an object in the world coming and going, but is just the stable, very simple me. And once we kind of let the body and mind relax and give ourselves a little inner space, we can start to notice, as though it's notice in the sense that this self-shining conscious being that I am comes more to the forefront because my mind is noticing it. Your mind is so involved with itself. Right? It takes the simple presence of your being totally for granted because there's never a time when you're not there. Whatever the thought is, you are there. Whatever the emotion is, you are there. And so the mind just takes all that for granted. But now we're saying, no, we're not going to take that for granted anymore. Because the mind gets lost in what we call samsara. It's totally lost in all of its, one thought leads to the other, leads to the other, and then we have an opinion about that thought, an emotion about that thought, and it gets a tangled mess, and the mind is drowning itself in this tangle. And so what we're doing is letting the tangle relax and noticing my own presence, the one that is illumining the tangle and untouched by the tangle. Illuminating the thoughts, like the sun illuminating a storm. The sun is illuminating the storm. The storm can be a thunderstorm. It can be clouds all dark and violent. There can be rain showers. There can be floods. All kinds of things can be going on. And the sun is just simply illuminating the whole thing. It is not saying, I am the rain cloud. I am the thunder. I am the flood. It's free of all of that, and at the same time, it's the one because of whom all of that is being experienced. Because of the light. It's not a perfect analogy, but it's useful. And so, in this series of logics. What Gaudapada is doing here, getting back to our text, he's going through everything that might enter your mind as to why the dream is different than the waking state. Because the problem is this. You know that the dream state is mithya, that it is a dependent reality that is not independent, that it depends upon you for its being. That mithyatva is accepted just as general knowledge. Right? But you don't know that this waking state enjoys really the same order of reality in terms of being mithya. And so there's many logics in your mind that, as the Gaudapada gives this initial statement, your mind could go, yeah, but what about this? That couldn't be true. What about this? What about this? And what about this? And so we're now going into a new one of those, what about this? So this one is interesting. We haven't chanted it yet, or did we?
No.
Okay. Let's chant it, and then I'll unfold it for you. Swapnavritta vipi twantaha, Swapnavritta vipi twantaha, Chaitasa kalpitam twasat, Chaitasa kalpitam twasat, Bahis chaito grahitam sat, Bahis chaito grahitam sat, Drishtam vaitatyameti yoho, Drishtam vaitatyameti yoho. Swapna vrittau, two. Antaha chaitasa kalpitam to asat. Bahihi chaitas becomes chaito, chaito grahitam, sat drishtam, vaitatyam etayoho. This is the objection. The Purvapakshi, the objector, this is his idea. And he says, you know, the dream state is obviously mithya because it's what we call, we got this from the last verse, it's stani dharma. It means that whole dream state is just, obviously, it's just my projection. It's just existing in my mind, right? It's mithya. It obviously comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. It's all my imagination. Okay? The dream said, that's a good way to say it. He said, this dream is obviously just my imagination. But in the waking state, this is waking state, is not my projection, right? I can have a projection in the waking state. But when I'm perceiving through my sense organs this world, that is not my projection. Where obviously the dream state, the whole dream state, it is my projection. So this is a huge difference, right? And so this is the objection in the person's mind. So how Gaudapada answers this? He says, "Swapna vrittau api." Vrittau means here just the same as stani. Stani means even in the dream state, swapna is dream. So even in the dream state, two just means also. If two just means, okay, we have these two states, the jagrat, the waking state, and the dream state. Now we're going to deal with this two. It means now we're going to deal with this dream state. He says, even in the dream state, antas chetasa, by thoughts, vrittis, thought modifications that are internal, right? The thought, kalpitam to asat, those which are imagined, right? The thoughts which are imagined internally, those are asat. Okay. Then he says, and those things which are perceived externally, those are sat, those are real. Okay. That's what he says. So he says, and we know by tatyam etayoho that both are mithya. Both states are mithya. So let me explain. We have a dream. Okay, you have a dream. you're dreaming of a meadow, okay? And in the meadow, you're walking around in the meadow with your friends, and you're experiencing, you're identified with the character in the meadow, the dream meadow, your dream character in the meadow, and you're experiencing the dream meadow through your dream sense organs, right? So now for you, as the dream character in the dream meadow, you will think that all that I'm experiencing out here through my sense organs, all of these things are real. In Sanskrit, we'd say these are all vyavahara. These all enjoy an empirical reality because I'm experiencing them. I'm not imagining them. I'm the dream character talking. I'm not imagining them, right? I'm experiencing them through my sense organs. But the dream character, again talking, if I were to experience a snake on a rope, mistake a rope for a snake, the dream character says, that would be just an inner imagination. I would be projecting that snake on the rope, and that would be asat. Asat means not real, right? Or if I had an imagination, that would be asat. That would be mithya. That would be unreal. And so these inner thoughts and inner projections, those are all asat. They're not real. But the things that I perceive through my sense organs, they are real. And yet we know from the vantage point of the waking state that in fact both are mithya. Both the whole dream that is being perceived through the sense organs is mithya, that it has no more reality, and I'll do a little bit more with that, it has no more reality, really, than the appearance of the rope, the appearance of the snake on the rope. They're both mithya. One doesn't have more reality than the other. They are both equally mithya. You can say, yeah, but one is a subjective mithya, like the imagination of the snake on the rope, and the other is an objective mithya, where the whole dream itself, right? That's an objective mithya, totally dependent on me for its being. And then within the objective mithya, there's a subjective mithya. We have words for this. Pratibhasika mithya and vyavaharika mithya. Pratibhasika mithya means my subjective reality, my projections, my thoughts, my emotions, my imaginations, my dreams. These are all pratibhasika. They're subjective. If I'm seeing a snake on a rope, you probably aren't. You're probably seeing the rope. That would be very unusual for us both to see the snake, right? Because it's a subjective projection. We would have to be having twin subjective projections, right? It's coming out of my mind. And so I just naturally accept that as mithya. And so the dream character will accept it also. You're walking around, you're walking along with your friends in the dream, going along a path, and you become very frightened because you've seen a snake, tripped over a snake along the path. You know? And your dream friend has to say, look and see what's happened, I didn't see any snake, and then sees that rope and says, oh, I know what happened to you. Yeah. You projected that snake on that rope. How many bends did your snake have? It had 3 bends in it. How wide was it? It was an inch and a half, maybe. Did it bite you? Oh, yes. I think that was the trance. He shows him, see those 3 bends? See the inch and a half? See the twine sticking out of the rope? And when the friend looks at it, he says, yeah, thank God. It's like waking up from a bad dream. It's the same thing. You wake up from a bad dream. You wake up from, a mithya snake bite. So the mithyatva of the snake bite, of the snake, the dependent reality of the snake, for that dream character, once they see the rope, totally accepted. But now say, that dream character goes to a Vedanta class. You know? The Mandukya. And all of a sudden, that teacher is talking about whatever you are perceiving also is mithya. That this also is a totally dependent reality. This has no being of its own. So we have an object of mithya because it's not subjective coming out of your mind, but it's an object of mithya. And you say, yeah, but the object of mithya is more real than the subject of mithya. No. No. They're both mithya. So Swamiji will laugh sometimes and just, the one is a bigger joke. That's all. Right? It lasts longer, but it doesn't make it any less mithya. And so for us, when I'm explaining this in reference to the dream, that's very simple to see because you already recognize the mithyatva of the dream. And so now what he's doing is using, showing this, pointing this out to the one who's having this objection, that actually this same mithya, objective mithya, and subjective mithya takes place in the dream as well as in the waking state. And so you can't use this argument, because the argument that you're using to establish the reality of the jagat is already happening. Jagat means the world, is already happening in the waking state. And you know in the dream state, and you know the dream state is mithya. See what I mean? And so you can't use that objection to say that the dream state is mithya and the waking state is not based upon that. You can't do that. So he takes this first verse, and let's go to the second one. He just turns it around for the jagat. Jagat means world. Jagrat means waking state. Okay. Jagrat vritta vapi tvantaha. Jagrat vritta vapi tvantaha. Chetasa kalpitan tvasat. Chetasa kalpitan tvasat. Bahish cheto grahitam sat. Bahish cheto grahitam sat. Yuktam vai tatyametayoho. Yuktam vai tatyayetayoho. Jagrat vrittau api tu antaha chetasa kalpitam tu asat. Bahihi cheto grahitam chetas cheto grahitam sat yuktam vai tatyam. So here he turns it around and he says, in the waking state, jagrat vrittau, in the waking state also, two differentiates the waking from the dream, that which is kalpitam, imagined by the internally by the mind, antas chetasa, that which is projected, imagined internally by the mind, that is asat. We accept that as mithya. We accept that as apparent. We don't take the snake to be real. Right? We know that it's imaginary, or that it's projected, or that it's dependent on the rope for its reality. We know that. And he said, and similarly, bahis cheto grahitam sat, that which is perceived externally using the sense organs. So bahish cheto is external consciousness. External consciousness, all that means, from that's taken right directly from the Upanishad. What it means is the external consciousness is all of this perception that has required my sense organs. Right? And so what I perceive externally, we take this to be real. What is just taking place in my mind is a projection. We take that to be asat, not real, dependent, mithya. So he says, since this is exactly the same, he said, as in the dream, he says, yuktam vaitachimetayoho. It is appropriate, it is proper to see the vaitatyam, the mityatva, of both, right? Both the sad and the asat. You don't have, this is the idea, that if you're using the dream state to establish the reality of this world, which is perceived by you, then if you understand that what I perceive in the dream state is as mithya as what I project in the dream state subjectively, then that same condition that we have here then should just establish that it is also mithya. Right? You were using it to establish that the world of perception, the perceived world, the waking state, is real. You were using this argument to prove that this waking state was real in that it differed from the dream state. And now what Gaudapada is saying is actually the example that you used, right, does not at all prove any difference from the waking state. And so if you're going to use that argument, it's proper for us to accept that this world enjoys the same level of reality, mithya, as the dream state, because you're the one that used the argument. Everybody understand how that goes? One thing. The Upanishads establish, teach, unfold Advaita, non-duality. The Upanishads will unfold that everything that we experience, in fact, within duality, comes into being and goes out of being. It is perceived, and therefore it must have a perceiver, subject-object relationship. All of these things require that it exist within duality. Duality is bound by space and time, and so as we analyze this creation, we don't find any substance here. We don't find any substance out here. What we find is every experience that we have enjoys a changeless substance, which is my own being, my own self. And so that's the beautiful vision that the Upanishads are unfolding. Now Gaudapada is trying to unfold this vision, not using the Upanishads, but just accepting what the Upanishads say and then trying to attack it logically. Let's prove that this isn't true, what the Upanishads say. Let's establish, actually, that this world, this waking state, is real. That it's not mithya, that it's not dependent upon anything, that it is its own being. That the existence that it enjoys belongs to it. You know? So let's try to establish that that is real. And so we're going through, to establish that it's real, you have to show that it enjoys a different order of reality than the dream state. Right? Because we know that the dream isn't real. Right? So you have to be able to establish that somehow this waking state enjoys a different order of reality than the dream state, or, what they tried to establish a little earlier, or that the dream state is also real. You could do that too. This waking state is real, the dream state is real. Yeah? Or the dream state is not real as mithya, and this state is real. So you have to try to establish it. And he's going to, as we go through this, bring up every conceivable option, every conceivable option that exists out there that he could think of anyway. Somebody else might be able to think of other arguments, but everything that he could possibly think of to show you that you cannot establish that this creation that you experience has an independent existence. That you're not able to. It doesn't matter what argument that you bring up. You won't be able to do it. And so he's just going to go on and on proving to you that you can't establish the absolute reality of this creation. You can't give being to it. You can't give substance to it. And it's not until, and this is part of the teaching methodology, it's not until that is thoroughly established, the mithyatva, where you realize that you actually can't say that this world, you don't have any logical basis to say that this world that we experience has any more reality than the dream. In terms of what is its substance, substratum. But I'm not able to say that. Once you get to that position, then we can, the next chapter comes along and establishes what is actually here. You know? It's like, say, if you mistaken a rope for a snake, you know, he's going on and on and on and on about how the snake can't be real. And then pointing to the rope. That's not the best example. Let me give you the best example, the one that we used. It's kind of important for understanding the whole teaching methodology. The example we actually, even though that's true, it doesn't work for an example here. The example that we use is the tenth man story. There's something, the tenth man story, in a sense, it shows the whole teaching methodology of Advaita Vedanta, of the Upanishad. This is the story, you all know it, I'm just going to do it very briefly. 10 boys are on a hike in India, they're in the Himalayas. One of the boys is the leader, like a scout leader. 10 boys are on a hike, and they come to a river. And the leader says, okay, let's cross, because then we it's much nicer on the other side. Let's cross this river, and then we can continue on the hike. So he gets all the boys together, and they head off across the river, which looks fine. It's wide and a little bit currenty, but no problem. So there they go. They're off. But as they get in the middle of the river, it is a little dicey. It becomes that is more rapids than they expected. It was a little bit scary. They get over to the other side. The leader's a little bit worried. He's okay, but he's a little worried because it wasn't as easy as he had expected. He calls all the boys together. Let me count them, just to make sure. And so he counts all the boys. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then he goes, where's the tenth man? 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Where's the tenth man? And so now all the boys are looking around. There's only 9 of us. You know? And the leader is getting very worked up inside. Because where is he? You know, where is he? This guy, he might be hiding, you know. So he sends the boys out looking, and he sends a couple of the boys running down the river just in case. All the boys are looking like crazy. They're not finding him anywhere. And there's an old sadhu sitting over, you know, looking out onto the river, and he sees all this commotion. And he comes over and he sees the leader, who's now getting distraught. Because he is now starting to think the worst, that this boy is drowned in the river or been carried away. Anything could have happened. So the old sadhu comes over and he said, what is wrong? I see you boys are all so upset. And boys start coming back and gathering around the sannyasi. And the leader says, we think that we've lost one of the boys in the river. I don't think he made it across. He's very worked up and very upset. And the sadhu says, well, how many were there of you? And the boy says, there were 10 of us, and now there's only 9. And so the sadhu looks, you know, at all the boys there, and he says, I can show you the 10th man, I know where he is. And now at this point, all these boys, and the leader especially, goes, oh, where? Because the sadhu, they have shraddha. Shraddha means they have certain, that he's a sane man, he's not some kooky guy. He's a sane elder. And so all of them start feeling relief. Where is he? Where is he then? And the old man says, just a minute, I'll show him to you. Don't worry, I'll show him to you. So they're all calming down, they have no idea where he is. And so he says to the leader, I want you to line up all your boys. So all the boys line up. He says, now I want you to count them. And now the leader becomes kind of upset, even though he's going to do it. He's upset because he's already counted several times. Right? But he counts. He has that shred okay, I'll count. He says to the leader, Swamiji can tell the story for an hour, by the way. He says to the leader, the leader says to the old sadhu, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. You know? He says, you just count. He says, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And he looks at the old sadhu. See? You know? See? And the sadhu says 10. Okay. 10. Now, that wouldn't have necessarily worked if he hadn't eliminated all of the other possibilities. Each man that he eliminated, right? One possibility down. One possibility down. Nine possibilities down. When he said 10, there were no options. That's the teaching methodology. So here, Gaudapada is removing all of the options. So this world is real because of this. It's real because of this. Well, both the dream and waking are real because of this and because of this and because of this. And so he comes up with actually very beautiful arguments. You know? And the dream drishtanta, the dream is used as an illustration because of our tremendous familiarity with it and our clarity in reference to the dream of several things. One is, when I'm having a dream, when I'm in that dream is real. I have to wake up. I have to wake up for the dream not to be real. When I'm in the dream, this chair is heavy. If I pinch myself, it hurts. I'm having a relationship conversation with you. I can be scared in the dream. I can be terrified in the dream. I can be happy in the dream. I can have all the emotional realities in the dream. I can be so sad, you know, when I wake up from the dream. Or I can be so relieved and get so involved in the dream. But once I wake up from that dream, you know, there's a couple of things that I notice, especially when I point it out to you. You notice that, first of all, the dream has disappeared and you're still there. That's quite a big thing. But you know what else is really interesting? And this is what we mean by mitya. This panoramic vision of the dream is gone, and at the same time, nothing has happened. This huge story, full of color and activity, you know, this whole in reality disappears, leaving what is actually there. Actually, nothing has happened. And yet, there was a dream creation and the absence of a dream creation, but what was actually there hasn't been touched in any way. Another way of saying this, I'm spreading that out more than just your recognition that you are still there. It's more than that, though. The mityatva of the dream is visceral. It has gone, and everything, being what gave it truth, what gave it being, is still completely there. We know that. We know what else we know? Is that when I wake up from the dream, there is no death experience. That's very interesting. There's no death experience. You were identified with a character in the dream. You were a character in the dream. That character goes away. There's no death experience. At all. Zero. That is the satya-mitya relationship. And so once we understand that, and even within that dream, same with the waking state, you can have subjective projections, like you can project a snake on a rope. You can have imaginations in the dream. You can have a dream within a dream. I don't know if you've ever had that experience of having a layered dream. You know, dream within a dream, kind of imaginations within the dream, projections within the dream. You can have the pratibhasika, the subjective reality, and the objective reality are there in the dream. Yeah. And while you're in the dream, it's completely real. But from this vantage point, we know it's mitya. both the subjective and the objective. Both are mithya. We know that. We're very clear about it. And that's why Swamiji said, you know, this dream illustration is what we call the Achilles heel to our conviction that this world, you know, is so real. Because every argument we use, that argument is already there, can be used within the dream, context of the dream. And so this dream illustration is something that we get a lot of mileage from. We don't depend on it fully at all, not by any means. Because we can analyze our own experience in this, we don't really even need it, actually. It's just so helpful. It's so nice. But we can establish the mithyatva of this creation without it. Things that come into being and going out of being have non-being on the prior and posterior non-being. That's mithya right there. Nothing comes out of nothing. And so that nothing, there's no such thing as nothingness. It doesn't exist for anything to come out of it. And so these things that come into being and go out of being must depend upon something else. And that something else is free of it. That's why you are free, completely free of all of your thoughts, of all of your emotions. Completely. But they're not free of you. Right? If you have an emotion, it enjoys your being. But your being is not changed by that emotion. Otherwise, what happens? That emotion leaves, it's going to take you with it. That's not your experience. You are the self of every experience that you have. I had this experience, I had this experience, I had this experience, I had this experience, I had this experience. This me remains constant. And so when we do this teaching, when we do nididhyasana, different types of contemplation, we're just giving you a chance, like say if we do in meditation at the beginning of class, we just give the mind a chance to just be with the fact of it, the fact of the changelessness of my own presence, and to understand the necessity of everything that comes into being and goes out of being, being mithya. It's a logical necessity. It's not just a made-up thing. It's a word. This mithya is a word that is talking about an order of reality that we experience. And the order of reality that we experience includes the waking state, the dream state, everything that exists within duality. Because everything that exists within duality is subject to coming and going, is subject to change, is subject to objectification, and therefore just is also dependent on seer seeing. There's so many things that we're going to be going through. Establishing all of this, it's an amazing thing. And it's not talking about anybody else, it's talking about you. You know? It's talking about the big who am I question. You know? Who am I really? And what is the relationship of myself to God, and to this creation, and to Ishvara, to God? You can say, there is no God. Well, that remains to be seen. Depends on what you mean by God. Yeah. I'll say like this. If we talk about what is the Upanishad dealing with? It's the jiva. The reality, the true nature, which is like that. This, what is the truth? What is the true nature of the jiva, the individual, this person here? This creation, the jagat, you know, and Ishvara, God, jiva, jagat, Ishvara. What is it? What is Ishvara? What is God, if there is one? What is it? What is this creation? What is its reality? And who am I in the whole thing? And the Upanishads will say, you are the whole thing. There is only one. There is only one non-dual being. That the self of the jiva, of the individual, is the self of the creation, is the self of Ishvara. So they'll use the example Say you have an ocean, huge ocean, and with countless waves. The waves are all the jivas, all of the individuals, including all of the animals. Animals are living beings. Plants are living beings. So all the living beings, you know, all of the names and forms will even go like that. All of the names and forms, all of those are the waves. Big waves, small waves, tumultuous waves, gentle waves, the whole ocean, all the different types of waves. All of those waves exist in one ocean. Right? So you would say the whole ocean, you know, is comprised of waves. All of the waves make up the ocean. And then all of the laws of the ocean also, all of the laws of the ocean, you know, are affecting the relationship of one wave to the other. So, but all of the waves, they all exist and are held by the ocean. Right? And there are countless waves, but one ocean. Right? Countless waves, one ocean. But the Vedanta will say, oh wave, you are the ocean. And the wave will say, I'm not the ocean. I'm not the whole ocean. I'm just a little wave. No, oh wave, you are the ocean. How could that be true? Well, it's true because the wave is water and the ocean is water. And the only thing there really is water. There's one water there. And if I look at the water from the perspective of the whole ocean, then I say that's Ishwara. That's God. That's the God ocean. And if I look at the same water from the perspective of a wave, that's the individual. But really, the wave ocean are mitya. The water is satyam. The water is what is actually there. The wave is part of the ocean, but the wave and the ocean both are nothing but water. That's Advaita. There's only one water. And so here, your being, this very beautiful, simple presence that makes you you, this simple me that you are, is very beautiful. To just recognize the beauty of your own self, all you have to do is just relax. Let the mind just relax, let the body relax. Just notice your own presence. Don't worry about it, just notice it. Yeah. That presence we discover is the presence of the jiva, all jivas, all individuals. It is the one presence of the jivas, the one presence of the creation, the one presence of God. Why do we even say creation versus God? It's because we'd say the creation, to everything that exists within time and space, is God. Because this whole creation is a conscious being. If I say the whole ocean is water, I can say the whole creation is conscious being. And so since the creation is a conscious being, we say it's Ishwara. It enjoys me as its being. There's many different ways the Upanishads will make you come to understand that. But that is what the vision of the Upanishads is. That this very beautiful being that you are. We don't always think of ourselves as so special or so sacred or so beautiful because our mind is upset or we're angry or we've done some naughty thing. All these things. That's the mind. And things that I get myself into this problem or that problem, all that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you. The one who is always present like the sun. Is always present. You are always, but the sun's up here and away, but it's not stained by what it's illuminating. Your being is always available to you, and it's just simple, pure form. You just have to notice it. So Vedanta, what Vedanta does is hold up that mirror to you, to notice, to recognize yourself, because the mind is just lost in its samsara, really, because it needs somebody to hold up a mirror. That's what the Upanishad does. It holds up a mirror to your own presence. It's like, you know, the tenth man, When the old sadhu says to the tenth man, "You are the tenth man," how is he going to feel? You know, like some Jew would go, "I'm enlightened, I'm enlightened."
Boy, I was mistaken.
It's embarrassing, kind of. but here, it's just such a simple thing. It's such a simple thing once we know. But what we have to know. It's obvious once we know. And I think knowledge is like that, you know. It's obvious once we know. And it solves so many problems once we know. Okay, let's stop here. Let's take a moment. Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Talking about last week and took it before,
yeah.
The pulling back of the reeds,
huh? Yeah,
and the seeing, an experience of seeing something. As I understand it, the difference between that being an experience, the difference between having this knowledge, recognizing the self, what it is, there kind of has to be an is, a categorical difference, right?
Sorry, I lost you.
Okay, there has to be a categorical difference in the sense that one is an experience and the other is, you know, one is an experience that kind of you go into and come out of, and the other is a recognition, as you say, of something self-evident. Right? And so I'm asking this because I think that recently I've been having, you know, there's some sense in which the reeds are kind of being moved apart, and
yeah,
I'm saying something,
yeah.
But I'm also aware that that's an experience, you know, and I'm trying to kind of encourage that, but I know that that's not, I have the feeling and I get the sense from what you've said and I've known you say in the past that that's, you know, that's like a flavour, but it's not it, you know, it's not the same thing, it's not what we're talking about, really.
Well, first of all, every example, including this one, has problems, right? Because it's if I pull the reeds apart, then I'm seeing something that I didn't see before. But that's fine. That part of it is good, you know. But then there's also, when I'm pulling the reeds apart, I'm seeing something that is actually being hidden by the reeds, right? So in this case, that's not true. The self is never being hidden by actual physical deeds or by like an actual physical state of mind, or as though ajnanam, ignorance itself, is like a cover that actually closes over so that you can't see yourself. The mind is never in a condition where the self isn't fully, totally, experientially present, ever at any time. So in that way, there is nothing ever that covers you. So ajnanam is not a physical, it's not a physical cover. It's a self-ignorance that causes your being to be superimposed by this is the problem of the mind, it's not the problem of consciousness. The mind takes itself to be you. Right? It's not that you're not totally there. It's like kind of like if I say the pot, in the clay pot, the pot takes itself to be the clay. Now, what's so interesting about it, if we use the clay pot, the pot is the clay. Right? There's nothing there but clay. The pot is the clay. Your mind, your body, the whole body, it is conscious being as much as the pot is the clay. But the problem is that you don't recognize the satya-mitya relationship of it, where the conscious being that you are, which is fully present and the very self of the mind, is not changing, is not objectifiable, while everything about the mind is changing and objectifiable, except itself. And that self that the mind takes itself to be, it is the self that you are. And so now, that doesn't require a state of experience. But the problem is that when we think about gaining knowledge, we only think really, because of our experience in the world, we think about having an experience, pulling the reeds apart, having an have the mind having a certain type of vritti in which the self is experienced. And then when I'm not having that shanta vritti or that subtle type of vritti, then the self, the reeds are back and the self is covered over. Right? This is exactly the very hardest thing for any Vedanta student to understand. Not just a Vedanta, I don't even mean it like that. We're asking the mind to do something that it's totally not used to doing. Because we are used to having one experience negate another. Like, for instance, I use the experience of this painting on the wall. I need my mind to focus on the painting, using my eyes, right, to gain a vritti of the painting, and now I have knowledge of the painting. It means I have the experience of the painting. Using my eyes, I now have a thought modification, and so now I have an experience of the painting, right? But if I turn like this, now I'm not having an experience of the painting. Right, because my eyes are not looking at it anymore. So that pain is gone now. So this is true. This is how it is in the world. I need to have my sense organs or direct my mind toward a certain experience. Then I illumine that consciousness, illumines that experience, and now I have the experience of it, right? Are you totally clear on that in terms of how we gain knowledge in the world? Now, what we do now is we apply this very same thing to the self. And this is kind of the thinking of it. Okay, so now I have to have a thought modification that can take place through this teaching or however it was, a thought modification, a kundalakara vritti, we call it, of the self. And when that is there, then I have knowledge of the self. But when it's not there, you know, then the reeds cover back over. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. Now the reeds are covered back over because the mind is not focused on self. I'm just applying the same way of getting knowledge toward external objects. Now I'm applying it in the same way toward my own being. And so then I feel the reeds keep coming over. They keep closing over. I need those reeds to stay open. I need my mind to keep itself focused on the self so that I'll just always be present. Otherwise, I keep losing myself. My mind keeps losing me because it's losing its focus or something. But this is not the same situation. Are you ready for this next step? Really? Because this is so important. Here, these objects that I objectify, these objects aren't consciousness, so to speak. They're not self-effulgent. These are all existing within Maya. I need to illumine them, right? If my sense organs aren't there, creating a thought modification in my mind, that's not going to be experienced. I need to have the thought modification in my mind, which then is illumined by consciousness, in order for it to be experienced. But in this case, the case of me, I am the consciousness. I am the conscious being. There is never a time when I'm not my own self-experience, self-evident. Never a time. The consciousness itself has nothing to do, it does not require any vritti at all for the self-evident experience of me to be there. That's why you notice I am continually present, the self, the conscious being, that illumines every thought, vritti means thought modification. I am the conscious being that illumines and is present to every thought that I have. I'm not lit up by the thoughts. But we think now that the thought has to light me up. The thought has to focus on me. It has to light me up. That isn't true. What the thought has to do is to remove the ignorance that had caused the mind to superimpose its qualities on me. So all I need to do is remove the ignorance. I don't have to keep remembering who I am because I'm the self-evident one that is never not there. It's not a matter of memory, right? But because we're so used to thinking in terms of vrittis, thought modifications, you're wanting the mind to be remembering you as though, that it has to perform a function of remembering you. Once the ajnanam is gone, that function is not necessary because you're the self, there's you're never a way to forget yourself. You see what I'm saying? But you're looking at your being in terms of a mental experience, even though it's a mental experience directed inward. Does that make sense? Not completely.
Not completely, but yeah. So what role and importance do those experiences have then? Because it's about something that's it's very different, isn't it? So it's
well, that's why we do nididhyasana, you keep doing shravana, because the mind itself is so capable of getting lost in itself. It gets lost in its emotions, it gets lost in its likes and dislikes, you know? And you keep bringing it back to the self that you know.
So they're kind of helpful, they make one more conducive to the possibility of that recognition, right?
I would go like this. That is also true, that say when you're doing the, what we call shravana, manana, nididhyasana, you're exposing yourself to this teaching methodology, you're doing that all the explanations and the logic and all that, so your mind is seeing it and getting it, you know. And then we do contemplation to be able to kind of own up what you're seeing at the time of teaching. But it takes a while for what you're seeing at the time of teaching to be what we want you to be seeing at the time of teaching. You see and you don't see. You know, and the major bugaboo is this exactly what we're talking about. This is exactly what it is, because we're looking for a state of experience the mind to have a state of experience, rather than recognizing the self that is present to every state of experience. It's a very different thing there.
So pursuing those experiences then is a problem, right?
I would say like this, it's nice to have the shanta vrittis and to have a quiet meditative mind. But you always have to resolve that quiet meditative mind into the self that is not dependent on the quiet meditative mind. That's what's so important. It's nice to have shanta vrittis. It's also as your mind recognizes that your being is the very source of the ananda or the fullness that you're seeking, that takes a lot of pressure off, you know. If you think that my feeling of wholeness, my feeling of happiness is dependent on fulfilling this set of desires, you know, that my life should go in this particular way, or this has to happen, that has to happen, that's so much pressure, and there's so much angst, and so much disappointment also when we start fulfilling these desires, and you fulfill the desire, you work so hard for it, and you thought this would be the end all, you fulfill the desire, and you have some moment of happiness, but then you're just back to good old you, and you have the fulfilled desire, but you're just the same. That's how it is. So all that disappointment goes away, all that angst goes away. You know, as you recognize more and more, you understand more and more that the very source of the ananda, the fullness you seek, is the very nature of your own being. It's just the agitated mind that makes that as though seem to go away, because the agitation is competing with your own presence. You know, pain is competing with your own presence. It's like, say if you break your arm or something, pain is definitely going to be competing with your presence. Well, emotional pain also is competing. But the difference between somebody who has self-knowledge and doesn't is even if there's emotional pain there, or physical pain there, your presence is also there. Right? It's been differentiated. It's always been there. But now it's a refuge for the mind, right? So that's a beautiful thing. But there, where I'm going with that though is that as the mind recognizes that what it seeks in life, the ananda, the fullness that you seek in life, is really your own nature, it more and more relaxes, just to enjoying your own being and enjoying your being. It's like instead of living. Experiencing the world for happiness, let me have this so I can be happy, let me have this so I can be happy, happily I experience the world. That's a much nicer situation. You know? And that ananda, that fullness of myself, it's not an object to be dependent. It's not subject to time. You know? It's not subject to change. And so my mind more and more relaxes. And we like that. We like to have a mind that is relaxed and happy. But we said that natural happiness that the mind gains from self-knowledge is what we call just a secondary pala, secondary result. That really isn't moksha. Moksha is recognizing the self that is always free, no matter what. You don't need your mind to be this way or that way or this way. Your mind naturally becomes relaxed. Because it's not, doesn't need to ask the world, well, please give me this and give me that and give me this, you know, and please don't do that to me and don't hurt me in this way, and on and on and on, trying to protect myself. My mind can relax into the ananda itself and then be more objective in the way I deal with the world. That's such a relief. But the truth of it all is the recognition of me that is always the same. Always the same. So, you know, when we talk about the gestalt, where your own presence comes way more to the forefront. Not that it's walking up to the forefront. It's just that the viveka, discrimination on the part of your mind, is so much that just the silence and wholeness of your own being is never missed by the mind. The behavior of the mind circles around the fact of your being. But your being is self-evident. It doesn't require the mind to illumine it, because it's the very self and luminosity consciousness that the mind is enjoying. The mind has to recognize that the consciousness that it enjoys, the being that it enjoys, the me that it enjoys, is free of it, not dependent on it. And recognize the stability of yourself. So there's a kind of a maturity, the maturity of exposure. Because remember, you come to this knowledge, you come to this knowledge that there is, the mind does have that self-ignorance. And having that self-ignorance, which is natural to it, it's not that you're ignorant and this person isn't. Everybody suffers from that self-ignorance. You're born with it. It's a natural. You know, and so everything, all of your habits, all of your ways of thinking, all of your ways of relating to the world are based upon that superimposition. You know. And so that has to unwind. You should just walk around noticing what never leaves. What about you never leaves? Can't get rid of it. Can't be without it. Doesn't matter what you're thinking, what you're feeling. The one who is always present. And then you get used to that. Oh yeah, I'm always here. Completely, not partially.
A friend of mine said once that like having a really extreme Shantavritti was kind of like looking through a telescope at the top of a mountain and seeing the place that you wanted to get to, but then you realize that you're actually where you are and that there's all of this sort of distance yet to be traveled to it. Do you agree with that? That's like a pretty apt.
I think that is exactly the problem. That is definitely the feeling, and that is the thing that has to snap.
What's the problem with, what was it again?
It's as though you say you have, and we've all probably have several of one or two or some of these in your lifetime, you have an extreme Shantavritti.
Mm.
If that's like a meditative state, it doesn't have to be even in meditation, just for one reason or another. Your mind has an state of extreme subtlety. And it is in a beautiful, exalted state. Beautiful, you know. And then you think that that exalted state is the self. And so then you need to, how can I get the reeds open again? So that I can have that glimpse of the beauty of myself. Say, that is not it. That is the beauty of an exalted Shantavritti. That's what that is. And it is very beautiful. And there are very beautiful Shantavrittis, deep absorptions, beautiful ananda, so many different meditative experiences that are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But then you think, that's me, and that is not. That is a Shantavritti that you can say is reflecting me in a way, but if you say that, then you think that, if you say, well, that Shantavritti is reflecting me, then when the Shantavritti goes away, then you're no longer being reflected. That's a mistake. So the Shantavritti is not reflecting you. You have to look at it more like the mind. Say there's the mind, the sattva, reflecting capacity of the mind. You know, when it becomes very, very quiet, you know, it as though becomes luminous from just the nature of the self. But it's reflecting luminosity in a way that is different than the self. You have to recognize this would be a good exercise for you. When you have an extreme Shantavritti or a beautiful meditative state, then you just ask yourself, just focus on the one who's illumining that meditative state. And there's a difference. The one who's illumining the self of the meditative state is the self of the depressed state, is the self of the normal state. is the changeless being that is so, how can I say it? Meditative states are nice, depressed states aren't, right? There's a continuum. There's a continuum. But I'm the truth of all of them. And there's something that is so simple and so pure and so inviolate about the simple presence of your being that is not made any better or worse by a vritti.
So you say that to yourself even in a painful state as opposed to a meditative state.
You're being in a pain, if your mind's in a painful state, you want to do certain whatever things that you need to do to get rid of the painful state. Maybe it's inner child work or taking some deep breaths or just bringing your mind home to relax it out of the painful state. Because we would rather not be in the painful state. But my being is exactly the same. And that's the thing. So now the problem is when you have this, like, I totally understand the metaphor, I believe. If you have this, you get a glimpse of this very extraordinaire, vritti extraordinaire.
Yeah, related, very elated.
Yeah, very subtle, subtle, subtle. Then you think, this is how I'm always supposed to be.
Yeah.
But that's so far away from where I really am on a normal day-to-day basis. Right? Yeah. That means that I have taken the exalted mental state to be myself or a window into myself. And that isn't true. Myself is the self is the exalted state. And that the conscious being itself doesn't require any state. Consciousness doesn't require a vritti to light it up. Or to be act as a window. It requires ignorance to be removed. This is a really big thing. This is the big bugaboo for everybody. It's a very important thing to contemplate on and try to understand.
Nevertheless, after having that recognition, you're more you're gonna tend to be more in that state, or be you know, having your experience will be something approximating that state afterwards, right? You know.
Oh, the subtle vritti.
Yeah.
But it depends. It depends on what you're involved with at the time.
Right, but it's gonna be
your mind does gain a lot more peace.
Mm.
You know, but you can still have extreme states, normal states.
Right.
You know, you're reading your books, you're washing your dishes, you're talking to friends, you're doing this and that. Your being is always in the forefront, always exactly the same, but the mind is in a variety of states. You don't have anywhere near the amount of dukkha, suffering that you had before, that's for sure. You know, thank goodness. The reason that you have all of that suffering in the first place is all due to projection. But you know, this... You can have subtle states in the as much as you want, but that's not what it is. It's not to say anything negative about these subtle states,
mm-hmm.
or the natural subtlety of the mind. It's just you must recognize that that is the mind, and yourself is not a state. Yourself is always there in exactly the same way. That's the only thing. You can sit in samadhi, you can do all of that. There's nothing wrong in it. It's beautiful if you're inclined that way. Some people are more meditative than others. You could be sit in meditation all of the time. That doesn't matter. That's not the point. If you're sitting in meditation to maintain a mental state that you think is the self, that's ajnanam. That's ignorance, because your mind is going to take on different states, and that means you'll be losing yourself all the time. That means you've taken yourself to be a mental state. You know? Do you understand? Yeah. So you want to recognize yourself that is not a state. It's the very reality of all states. And that is moksha. Moksha is the recognition, means liberation. Moksha is the recognition of the liberated self. Yourself is liberated, it always has been liberated, always will be liberated. There's nothing can cover it, nothing can touch it, nothing can do anything about it at all, not even Ishwara. It's the very self of Ishwara. And it's not a mental state that comes and goes. And it takes a long time to get that. Well, it took me a long time to get it. But I also notice that with all my students and all my friends, it's taken everybody a long time to get it. That's the main thing. Remember I told last week, somebody, when I was at giving some, we were discussing some things when I was at the ashram, and some of the students that were just graduating for this 3-year course said, you know, what's the hardest thing to convey in your teaching? And this is what I said. This is the hardest thing. Because it's hard to recognize that it is yourself that's being, yourself that is the one that is changeless, is the self of Ishwara, is the Ananda. That's another beautiful meditation. How can the Upanishads say that you are the Ananda? You are the beloved. You are that wholeness, the fullness, that is you. You'll say, where's that wholeness? I need to have a mental state. Where's that wholeness? Well, that's a good thing to meditate on, because the very Ananda that they're talking about is fully 100% present right now as that which is the most dear to you. It simply has to be recognized. But if you think, oh, Ananda, it was just translated as bliss, they're talking about a state that's not present here, right now. And so then we have to try to get some sort of a mental state so that we can experience that bliss.
Well, it's also like that urge to have a better experience. I mean, it's got to be better than this.
Yeah, but what's to be recognized is that, of course, we don't want these painful vrittis, no doubt. But what you will recognize as you sit with it for a while is actually there is nothing better than the presence of your own being. There's no way to improve it. It's impossible to even conceive of. That's what has to be recognized. But that's there to be recognized. And you can do it sometimes. I'll do guided meditations like this. You can do it on your own. You know, as you're just relaxing and sitting with your own presence, you can just ask yourself, why do they say I am Ananda? What's Ananda about me? Why do they say the self, my being, is Ananda, or fullness, or wholeness? What do they mean? Because they're not kidding. They're not kidding. They're really, they're totally serious. So that means you can contemplate on this and see, what is it about me that is Ananda, is most dear, that cannot be improved upon? What is that? What are they talking about? Because they're talking about something that is here right now. So that's a good meditation.
I feel like when I do that, my state changes.
What?
When I do that, when I ask that question now, like my state changes.
Your state of mind changes. Right. The subtlety of mind changes. Yeah. But that's true. Those subtlety of mind will change continually. Become more subtle, become less subtle, they'll continue like that. Your being doesn't. There's a viveka there. Yeah.
But when you're looking at yourself, the mind, the state of mind seems to change.
It does.
Also.
No, state of mind continues to change. But you are exact present in exactly the same way through all of those changing states of mind. So just try for that one. One more question, there is that.
I just wanted a quick reminder. Like early on, you were talking about how. So like for me, I run around. I'm sad. I'm sad. I'm happy. I'm agitated. I'm anxiety. I'm sad. But earlier, before class, when we got into it, you had said something about like the self is illuminating Can you repeat that again?
Yeah. One meditation you can do about this. Say you say, I'm sad. Okay, now there's a total identification with your own presence
right.
and the sadness. Then just say to yourself, okay, I'm actually aware of the sadness.
Okay.
Okay, now there's one, there's a, now you have a little window, your little space between I am the sadness to I am aware of the sadness. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you've done that, now let the sad mind, right, resolve into or rest in the self that's even in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just try that as an exercise. It's like you let that sad mind just be in the presence of yourself that's illumining it, that's aware of it. And that's a very nice experience because
yeah.
yourself is not sad. So what that means is that the self then becomes the one who's holding
mm-hmm.
the sad emotion of the mind, and the mind relaxes into that. And really what's causing the sadness or the hurt in the mind is different forms of stress or tension in the mind. That's why, say you have, this is a good exercise too, if you have a real, say a sad or a hurt thought or something, is just to not push it away. You just be with it like a kind of a good mother. You know, you just be totally present to that and then just allow it to relax in your presence. You're just not getting rid of the sadness, not trying to push it away or get rid of it. You just accept it and let it relax into your own presence. And actually what's causing the sadness is the stress. You know. And the self isn't sad. Right? And so that dissipates it. You're not creating any more stress by trying to push it away or, you know, get rid of it or this or that. It's a really, it's a very good practice because you learn not to fear or get stressed out by different emotional states, or you don't like this person, or you don't like to be around this person. Well, you don't like to be around them because they create a stress in you. And so practice on the easier things first, you know, that way you can just let that be and you just don't push away, just relax. And then what happens is the person or the situation remains, but the negativity drops off.
So it is saying the self is illuminating, even if it's happiness.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
The whole spectrum. Your being is there as the self of the whole, the changeless self of the whole spectrum. So you want to start recognizing, well, who is this me that's always there? Who's the me that now is having this sublime vritti, this sublime meditative experience? And who is the me that's having this negative one? That one's in, that me is so stable, so inviolate. It's not being hurt by or exalted by any of these states.
Om.
Yeah.
May I ask something? Yeah, I just wanted to clarify, so then if I understand. So the self, that which we really are, is always here, and it's regardless of what the state we're in, and it's unaffected
unaffected
by its state,
yeah.
which is already whole and always has been, always will be.
Always will be. That's exactly right. So, discover that one. Yeah, good. That's right.
Yeah.